We shall start by talking about deer ticks, which may not be the most obvious connection. But deer ticks interest me because of the following peculiar scientific phenomenon. That often, people, since deer ticks are you know, a risk for Lyme disease, the people often think that the way to solve the Lyme disease problem is to get rid of deer. After all, they're deer ticks. But it turns out, apparently, that if you get rid of deer, what turns out is you have opossum ticks, or raccoon ticks, or something other than that, because it seems, at least one regnant theory is that deer ticks don't actually care that they are deer. They're happy if they're happy to attach themselves to deer should deer be there, but you don't actually diminish the number of ticks since you spent lots of time getting rid of the deer, and it turns out the ticks are still there. Now, this is actually a phenomenon that has intellectual parallels, in that what it shows up is that sometimes sometimes you think that there's a idea that occupies an ecological niche, and you think if you get rid of that idea, then all of a sudden, the ecological niche goes with it. It's one of the things that I like to try when I'm teaching, especially in the summer program, is to see what happens if we approach a popular topic, and we simply remove the idea which everyone thinks is central to it. Right, or the text that everyone thinks is central to it. So last year, when we studied Hilchot Lashon Hara, the tactic was to remove the Chavetz Chaim from the discussion and see what happens if you have to go a whole summer talking about Hilchot Lashon Hara and not quote the Chavetz Chaim. So what I'm trying to do in this series, this is part three of a five-part series, is to take on the notion that the ecological niche of speech ethics in halakha is occupied entirely by the category Lashon Hara. And I want to sort of illustrate the challenges with that by retelling a story I told in the first session, but I think I'm going to retell it with a somewhat more jaundiced view right now. The story is that I grew up hearing often, and it sort of was epitomized the approach to Hilchot Lashon Hara. The Chavetz Chaim is traveling incognito on a train, and a farmer, you've heard the story too, right? The farmer sits down across from him, and the farmer has no idea this is the Chavetz Chaim, and so he begins a conversation about manure, and which types of manure are best to spread on your farm. And the conversation lasts 5 or 6 hours, at the end of which they get to Raden, whatever it is, and the Chavetz Chaim steps off the train, and there are all his Talmidim there to greet him, welcome Chavetz Chaim, banner, all right, Tali Veroni Yoshevet Raden, whatever it may be, and the farmer is terribly embarrassed. Because here he had spent 6 hours talking to the Chavetz Chaim about manure. And the Chavetz Chaim told him, no, don't worry. Right? It was the best 6 hours I've had in years, because the 6 hours about Lashon Hara. Right, that's the... Now, the first session, we spent doing the Rambam, and the Rambam critiques the story, not the Chavetz Chaim, but the story, in the following way. Right? What he says is that the implications of this story is that the best you can hope for in conversation is neutrality, right? You start at zero, and the best you can hope for is to make sure that you don't do anything wrong. And that's, you know, that's a sort of negative vision. Now, we can start by contrasting that is, well, they could have spent 5 or 6 hours talking about Torah. There is Torah you can talk about with farmers, I assume, right? There's lots of psukim and chumash that seem quite relevant to farmers. So you could have done. Pardon? Not so much in Chutzpah as well, you know, it depends on Chadash. yes.
If we assume that the Chavetz Chaim was just saying that to make him feel better.
Sure, I'm not critiquing the Chavetz Chaim. I'm critiquing the story. Not the Chavetz, if you want to say the moral of the story is the Chavetz Chaim was nice to the farmer, no problem. But this story is usually told as we should all have the ambition of being farmers who talk about manure. Right. I think that's usually the way the moral is. They should all be zochet. It's madriga, being able to wander around all day, being farmers who have conversations about manure. And it's not right. The Rambam has a much more complicated taxonomy. Right, which is there's commanded speech, which is speech about Torah. There is beloved speech, and then he says there is trivial speech, and trivial speech you shouldn't engage in at all. Really, right? Except it's absolutely necessary. So he wouldn't have been so happy, I think. With the story, unless you couldn't do any better, right? When you can't, when the alternative is the gossip, so in Echinami you should talk about manure. But ideally, you should have positive conversations, uplifting conversations, things like that. That's one issue, is right, is that if you believe that Lashon Hara is the only animal that occupies the niche of speech ethics, so then you believe that the only thing you ever have to think about in speech is not saying Lashon Hara. But the Rambam is a very different vision, right? That speech is this powerful thing. Secondly, the effect of that story depends on it being a conversation about manure. Right? It's not anywhere near as funny if it's a conversation about widgets, I don't think. Right? Or ball bearings. Right? It just doesn't work at all. So that we talked about in the second week, which is the whole question of the category usually identified as nivlut peh or nivul peh, profanity and obscenity and issues like that, and how right, and talked about how the halakha, at least rabbinic literature, seems to have a somewhat more nuanced position about at what times it is appropriate to talk about what things in what way, and the sophisticated concept of language that is necessary to create situations in which euphemism is okay, even though euphemism makes you think about things. Right, that's the whole purpose of euphemism. Under what context, right, what context is necessary to engage in erotic speech, things like that, to complicate that notion and recognize that speech ethics is also not about avoiding topics. Right? Speech ethics is about figuring out how to talk about the right thing in the right way, and then to figure out how you balance that by your character, saying, like, what do you do with Gemaras that tell you that it's okay, that right, that it's okay to insult certain types of people by going after their mother? It's okay to come up with crude names for idols. Right, how you relate that in a broad context, and whether that's good for you, whether that's a way of channeling energy of people who do things like that, what you do with all sorts of issues like that. So this week, we're going to begin to put the term Lashon Hara back into the experiment, but slowly. And then the next 2 weeks, we'll try and we'll deal with the term Lashon Hara directly, but we will at least in the first week make the term mean something different than you're accustomed to. But I want to start this week by talking about a third category. Right, so we talked about the general notion of what speech is valuable. We talked about the notion of speech about what and how you talk about what, in terms of topics, particularly about topics that seem physical, that seem highly physical. I should mention in that context there's an inverse of that, which I'm not talking about, which is under what circumstances you can talk about God, and in what way, which is also an aspect of speech ethics. And we talked about last week how particularly speech about sexuality. Right? It's not always clear which are you in the issue. What I called is the risk profaning the sacred or sanctifying the profane. Right? Those are very different kinds of issues. Okay, so let's start with a text, rather peculiar notion, place to find the text about speech ethics, which is in the Laws of Commerce. So now in the Laws of Commerce, chapter 14 has it seems to be an aside. Although it's an aside that follows the organizational structure of the Talmud. He says, well, we've talked about this prohibition called ona'ah in the context of commerce. Ona'ah is some kind of prohibition associated with overcharging, although it would take a lot to define it. And I haven't done the effort, so I'm not even going to claim I don't have time to do it now. I couldn't do it if I wanted to right now. But the Torah uses parallel language for what the rabbis identify as a prohibition of ona'ah as it relates to finance, and a prohibition of ona'ah as it relates to words. Right, so the Rambam begins by saying that right, just as there is ona'ah in finance, so too there is ona'ah in words, and he quotes a verse, Lo tanu ishet amito, v'yareta me'alokecha ani Hashem, zehonayat zevarim. Now I shall also not make any effort whatsoever to find a conceptual parallelism between ona'ah of commerce and ona'ah of speech. It seems really likely it should be there, but I have never heard one that is remotely convincing. So I leave that to you to develop. Okay, so the Rambam asks Ketzad. Right? Ketzad always asks you for concrete illustrations of the right of a previous principle. So the principle is there is a category called ona'ah dvarim. And the Rambam gives the following list of examples. He starts off with reminding people of past deeds either of their ancestors or of their own. Right, Bali Tshuva, Gerim, descendants of Gerim, presumably descendants of Bali Tshuva. Any attempt to embarrass somebody by bringing up a past that is less honorable than their present. That is ona'ah dvarim. Then he has a second category, which is using speech to send people off on useless, right, send people off on wild goose chases. If somebody comes and asks you for who sells X and you send them to a store that doesn't sell X, now how those two relate is not at all clear either. And then you have the third category, which is calling on, asking people's opinions about things which they will not have anything intelligent to say about. Okay, right, those are, right, and then he says in all other things like this, but it's not at all clear what the common denominator of those is, and he concludes it with rhetoric about, how bad Hona'at Dvarim is, right, because you can't return it, and it affects the person directly as opposed to their money. Okay, now I want to just first point out these categories are taken very seriously halachically. So we have, this is source number two, we have a response of an Agershon Maor HaGola, which he takes the principle enunciated here with great seriousness. The question is whether a Kohen who had apostatized, who had converted out to Christianity, and then converted back, is allowed to do Nesiyat Kapayim. Is he allowed to do Duchan? Is he allowed to be called as an Aliyah, from Aliyah first to the Torah? Now there are all sorts of issues associated with Gershom and apostasy generally, which some of you may have historically, but I'm interested simply is in the argument, right, is in the argument he makes here. So he has a long argument in which he says, you know what, I can't find any reason, any technical halachic reason to forbid such a person going up, but there is an obvious, right, there is an obvious implicit reason, which is that in general, Kohanim are not supposed to do Birkat Kohanim if their very presence will be a distraction. Right, if people will go up and instead of thinking about the bracha, they'll be thinking about the personality. So Rabbi Gershon says, so that's a reasonable thing, but guess what? If you tell him that he can't go up, how could you have a greater example of reminding somebody of their past misdeeds than essentially requiring them to remain in the position which is conditioned by their past misdeeds? Right, he said, right, ein lecha ona agdola mizu. Right, there is no greater oppression than this. So that's a fascinating halachic implication extended beyond speech. Right, it says that in general there is an obligation. It's tempered. There are times when past actions have consequences, but there's a bias towards making sure that nothing you do halachically reminds people of past misdeeds. Right, so I want to say that. Yes, David.
What if it had been an aver that he really is possible from Birkat Kohanim for?
So I think, again, it's a bias. There are kind of, right? Rabbeinu Gershon knows perfectly well that there are, right, you know, that murderers can't do Nesiyat Kapayim. He might have a technical answer and claim it depends whether the failure to Nesiyat Kapayim is part of your tshuva. But more likely, I think he says, you know what? It's forbidden to embarrass people. But sometimes, halakhically, you're required to embarrass people. But whenever it's not required, you always go the other way. Okay, so that's right. So this seems to be like a really seriously taken notion that you make sure that when you're talking to people, that you don't bring in their past into the conversation. Now, the Chassam Sofer takes, in a sort of comic story, takes the notion of sending people on wild goose chases really seriously. This is verse number three. He addresses the case of a particular shochet who apparently decided if he knew there was some guy in his town who really, really liked being a mohel, and would walk huge distances to be a mohel. So he meets him on the street, and he says, "Guess what? My wife gave birth to a boy yesterday, and the bris is a week from yesterday, and I want you to be able to do the bris." So the guy takes a 4-hour wagon ride or something like that, right? He goes from Boston to New York, and he shows up, and it's a girl. everyone's standing around laughing at this guy. And the guy sues in Bezdin, and the Chassam Sofer rules that until the shochet apologizes in such a way that he accepts, he's removed from his position as a shochet. If you produce witnesses and demonstrate that this is in fact what happened, the person, right, you can't have a person, right, there's no reason you should have a person like this serve as a shochet. So that tends to raise the question of how you deal with practical jokes in a society. This is a complicated question because, you know, practical jokes serve a role in certain kinds of relationships. And I don't know if, right, if it turns out that the week before, right, that this guy who really likes doing mila had, you know, done some equivalent practical joke to the, right, to the other person, and in fact been engaging in a competition of practical jokes since they were six. Well, again, so is that you know, so sometimes I read some comedian who, you know, who really like runs his whole business, right, his whole comedy is built on engaging people in escalating wars of practical jokes, and I think we'd have a you know, jaundiced view of that. On the other hand, I think, you know, that again, in the context of a relationship where people actually enjoy each other's practical jokes, that might have a different valence. But it takes this notion really, really, really seriously. Okay, so that's right. So you have this very these two axes along which the Rambam sets up on Atzarim. One is reminders of the past, and the other is wasting people's time, essentially. Okay, now when you try and get a conceptual definition out of the Rambam, though, and this is verse number four, he gives you a very different definition, and it's worth thinking about how you integrate all these things. Here he says, the 251st mitzvah in the Rambam Sefer Mitzvot is against on advarim, and this is, he defines, as telling people things that pain them and anger them such that they are so humiliated they can't stand. Which is not quite the same thing as the examples. Right? None of the examples deal with just walking over to somebody and insulting them. Right? But here the Rambam, right, seems to come with a broader category. Not sure how that broad category fits into the specific examples. He adds in one, which so far as I can tell, nobody else mentions anywhere, but which is really important in our day, which is essentially making fun of disabilities. Right, somebody who teases people about physical imperfections that in a way that wounds them. So this also, you know, this opens up. I think this is, in many ways, the sort of the primary aspect of speech ethics in American society, is avoiding giving offense by saying things that end in, you know, that get you to be accused of being something IST. But the Rambam really serves as a valid halachic source for that notion that making fun of immutable characteristics in ways that pain people, that is a violation of onat dvarim. Okay. Now, I want to make two other points in the Rambam, and then we're going to read different texts together. Three other points in the Rambam. First point is in Rambam source number 5, which is the question of how you respond, right? So it's all very well to set up a speech ethic which says that you're not allowed to insult people, but what if they insult you first? Are you allowed to answer back or not? So the Rambam Hilchos Tshuva, right, the laws of repentance, says that the way, right, when he's discussing the characteristics of Bali Tshuva, what he says is, right, what he says is that Bali Tshuva tend to be extremely humble, and therefore, when they get insulted, what they say is, "Yay, I'm getting scarred for being insulted, and I'm being rewarded." And so they're really happy, and they encourage you, I guess, in a sense, to go on it. But it's really forbidden to do. Right? It's a little complicated dynamic in which, the Bali Tshuva is not, right, specifically is not supposed to respond when people remind them of their past deeds. Okay.
What if my kavanah is to give them schar, then is it okay?
So, yeah, the classic example of this, you know, I grew up on is Penina and Chana in the beginning of Shmuel, right, where Penina teases Chana about not having children in the hopes of arousing some kind of psychosomatic reaction that will make her more fertile. But we don't tend to praise her for this. Right, we tend to the Chiyas HaTzatzarag. Yes.
I'll look it up, I'm pretty sure.
Alright, I always thought that, yeah, that's explaining how Pina, who of course must have been a tzaddikah since she was married, right, to Elkanah, could have thought this. But I don't know that we actually justify it. Yes?
All these are focusing on something the person no longer does.
Mm-hmm.
How about if someone still does an Avera from time to time?
Good, we're going to get there.
Alright, got it.
We're going to get there. Right. But right now, I'm just setting. Right. You know, I just want to. I get really open up space. And say, you know, that here's a whole category of halakha that just gets ignored. Right? People, you know, we can have whole symposia on Jewish speech ethics and no one ever mentions. Really, you know, we do is, here's the way I would frame it, and we'll see this in a moment. We have a massive body of literature, halakha yomi, things like that, which talk about how to talk about people, and very little about how to talk to people. Right, and it seems to be like a reasonable starting point for speech ethics to figure out how to talk to people. Okay, now the clearest illustration of this in some ways, and this I think is really, again, what I'm, this is not a formal share, this is really, I'm really engaging the series in a joint exploration, so I'm asking the question, I don't know the answer, is, you remember that we started by putting on Atvarim, right, and saying the Rambam has on Atvarim, right, in the laws of commerce. Now here's the amazing thing, is in laws of character traits, chapter 7, the Rambam goes through a taxonomy of forbidden speech. And he says, in order, well, first there's the general category, which is miragel b'chavira. We don't know what miragel means there, so it doesn't help us any. But then he comes up with a taxonomy that the Chavetz Chaim makes famous, and that probably all of you know. Well, he says, well, look, there's rechilut. Rechilut is gossip. When you don't know whether it's true or not, you're just repeating hearsay. And then there is, there's a greater sin than that. That's lashon hara. Lashon hara is saying the truth, saying things that you know to be true about other people. Right? And then there's saying, then there's defamation of character. Hotzat shemra. That's different. Okay. So we have repeating hearsay. We have saying truth about others. We have defaming other people falsely. Then it creates a new category of a baal lashon hara. Definition of which is unclear. Somebody who spends their time habitually talking about other people in some way. Pardon? I don't think that's a technical definition. I don't know. You know, because the baal lashon hara. Why isn't it baal rechilut? I'm not sure how this fits. Then he says, and there are these things called avak lashon hara, which are, right, the penumbra of lashon hara, things that are sort of like lashon hara, they're not. And then he goes into nekama, which is revenge, and there's netira, which is a different kind of grudge holding. Where on earth is on atvarim? Right? I think this is an amazing conceptual mystery in the Rambam, that here he has his laws of character traits. He lists eight different kinds of forbidden speech, and yet on atvarim is shoved off somewhere into the laws of commerce, not even mentioned. Okay, that to me is an astounding phenomenon that deserves analysis. I gave you, you know, one easy way of framing it, which is to say that on asvarim is speech to others and lashon hara is speech about others, but it still begs the question: when the Rambam's talking about laws of character development, shouldn't it be as valuable to talk about how to speak to others as about others? Right. Yes, right.
I'm just wondering if the same reason why it's not addressed today, why Anat is not really spoken of today that much, is the same reason why the Rambam left it out here as well.
Which is?
Which perhaps is because it's so assumed that you're following those laws anyway, that a society, at the very least, people are not going to insult each other.
Doesn't feel like a very good assumption.
It's harder to be mean to you than I do to steal candy corn.
I don't know. I we're someone other than Rambam, we might say, "Oops, I freaking forgot," and he has to find a place. But I don't think, you know, that doesn't seem plausible in this case at all. There must be some rationale, and I'm. I know that doesn't strike me as a really convincing reason, because I get insulted too often.
and Rambam describes plenty of laws that are logical, right?
Yeah, no, what could be better for laws of character development, right, than talking about how to address other people? I confess, I just offer it up as something that I encourage all of you to think about and be in correspondence about. As a contrast, we can take a look at source number 7, which is a work called the Erchot Tzadikim. I believe it's an anonymous medieval work of character development. I should mention that my friend Rabbi Seth Kadish recommended this to me years ago. I still haven't read it all the way through, but I'm glad to at least be quoting it this year so he can get the credit for it. So he tells you, Kat misapre lashon hara nechleket l'shisha chalakim. It's a class of people who speak lashon hara can divide it into six classes. So he has his six classes of, right, here are his six. The first is somebody who says bad things about people. And he says whether true or false. That's category number one. Right? Category number two is when you say bad things about bad people to them. You know, not varim. That's the second category of lashon hara. Okay, category three is talking about your ancestral act, insulting you on the basis of your ancestors' actions in public. And category four is when you talk about the people's ancestors' fault in front of other people, not to their face. The fifth category is telling bad things about Balshuva's past. And the sixth category is saying negative things about public officials, which he thinks is a really bad thing because it drives the people of virtue out of public office and replaces them with people who have no concern for their own honor. It's a really interesting, right, I think this, you know, we talked about this last summer a lot. It's a really interesting thing about how you balance the need for public information, right, against the genuine thing that, you know, that many decent people get driven out of politics because they just can't deal with the innuendo. Right, they can't deal with the constant assault, and, you know, and really democratic politics sometimes are sometimes really just quite remarkably ugly. And this is not a modern phenomenon. There was a man named Thomas Callender, I think, right? It was the hired gun for various political parties in late 19th century America. He was just basically hired to write really vicious libels about the other party. And this was a perfectly common phenomenon. But I'm interested in the Orach HaTzadikim because his categorization is so wholly different. It has no point of contact with the Rambam.
But he includes some of what we call cases.
He merges the, right.
And
yeah.
The Rambam didn't even make that up. The Gemara says these are cases.
No, the Gemara says these are. Right, what the Rambam does is he radically separates lashon hara from anat varim. Right, the Orach HaTzadikim assumes they're the same thing. Right, lashon hara, and lashon hara and anat varim are really part of one broad category. I think it's valuable to understand, and we'll emphasize this more in the next 2 weeks, that the Rambam's clean, neat conceptual categorization, Refilut, Lashon Hara, Moti Shemra, all that is entirely creative. Right? Meaning nobody had those categorizations before the Rambam, and you know, once he made them up, they had tremendous resonance. But we should be aware that in no way exhausts the tradition. And part of that, I think, is that it's contributed to the removal of, right, because Onat Varim got defined out for whatever reason, so it just didn't make it in. So I think Yerusha Tzadikim is a useful corrective because he clearly thinks of Lashon Hara as, you know, more a comprehensive approach to interpersonal speech ethics, I would say. Right? Yes?
You might have mentioned this and I missed it. The
Orach HaTzadikim,
can you put them in time?
Orach HaTzadikim is later.
Do they know of each other? Might there
have been? Would the Orach HaTzadikim have seen the Rambam? I guess, but probably, right? Probably, we're talking about 13th century? 13th century Ashkenaz? That's it?
Had the Rambam reached Ashkenaz
by then? Rambam gets there pretty fast. I think the Rambam gets there pretty fast. He's in dialogue with Tehran the whole time.
I think it's one of the later 15th century Germany.
Okay, they know the Rambam. 15th century.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, but it's anonymous, right? Do they think they know who the author is?
Yeah. No,
okay. So
he knows the Rambam.
He's engaged in a different enterprise. You know, he's not writing a halacha book in quite the same sense. But I think that he just doesn't see the Rambam as a useful paradigm. Now, again, neither of them have cast the net as widely as I did by putting, you know, laws of profanity and obscenity into the same category. But you see the possibility of reorienting yourselves in fairly in fairly dramatic ways. But I think that if you were trying to come up with a conceptual categorization, right, then they really mean different things. And as we'll see in the next few weeks, I think that it's really important to separate the notion of speech ethics as a way of dealing with people as opposed to speech ethics as a way of regulating information. Right, the Rambam essentially defines speech ethics as a mode of regulating information as opposed to a mode of speech. Right, the only real issue is am I saying the things I should be saying? Whereas it may be that speech ethics is much more about how am I saying it, what am I accomplishing by saying it, things like that. But I wanted to set the Rambam up as a the Orchot Tzedekim up as a very different paradigm, and then you can conceptualize for yourself what you want to do. Now, what I want to do, however, is that in the body of the shir right now, is I want to read large sections of the Sefer HaChinuch to you. Sefer HaChinuch is 13th century Provence, I'm so rotten at dates. We now believe it was written by Rabbi Pinchas Halevi, about whom we know essentially he was the brother of Aharon Halevi. famously, Sefer HaChinuch was written as a bar mitzvah, review book, but nonetheless has lots of conceptual things in it. But what makes the Sefer HaChinuch really interesting is that he does make an effort to rationalize. Right? He provides rationales for all the commandments. So here's what he says. He begins by saying, and this is the point that we're going to return to repeatedly now, that the mitzvah is shlo lahanot echad mi Yisrael bidvarim. Not to oppress another Jew with words. Why? Right? Why is it another Jew? Kilamar repeats it. Shlo namar li Yisrael dvarim sheachivu v'yitzharu v'ein b'koch lehezer mehem. Now you shouldn't say to a Jew, and here he is coming off the Rambam of the Sefer HaMitzvot, right? Say to another Jew, matters that pain him and cause him suffering, and that he has no capacity to withstand. It begins by saying, Shorish mitzvah tzu yadua, the basis of this mitzvah is known, that's to create peace among people. Teich shalom ben abriyot, and then we have an encomium to peace, right? Peace is great, because peace is the conduit of blessing for the world, and dispute or dissent is hard, because it brings up many, many curses and other obstacles. Okay, now he gives you into details, and the first thing he says is, right, the rabbis have lots of rhetoric about this, which they say, Shol Hafiva Briot, Israel disappears when he talks about that, right, not to pain the Briot, right, people. B'shum Devar in any way, B'lo Levaisham, right, so now you have a broader definition, not to cause pain and not to embarrass. And then he says they went to an extreme. They said you can't even ask. Right, you can't even window shop when you don't have money. Now the interesting thing about that is that this doesn't involve speech at all. It's just hanging around, and he's trying to combine the categories somehow. Right, that it's right causing that really it's a prohibition against causing any kind of psychological pain. Right, that's it's a much much broader definition. And now he tells you a very interesting halachic rule, right? This is the first underlined section in Hebrew. It says, "Lo yeb efshar lichtos tatkol adrim sheish ben sar labriot." It's simply not possible to write down all the ways in which you can cause pain to people, right? Because right, there are lots and lots of ways to cause pain to people. Therefore, right, he says this is something which fundamentally, right, we began by talking about, this is fundamentally an ethical as opposed to a halachic category. Yes.
Just noticing that both the Rambam and the Chinuch at the beginning write something along the lines of Rainbow Kalach Le'al Zermeh.
Yeah.
Or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Rambam also wrote something like.
Sure. Yeah, we had that.
Yehol Amodba.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be the case in what he's saying now in the Mehem itself.
Yes. So I don't. You know. So some people try and draw the boundary. I tend to think that what you have here is a recognition that teasing is a way in which people relate to each other. And that, right, again, that the challenge here is to try and, we had the same issue today in Shir. We're talking about the boundaries of the prohibition against hitting people. The Rambam develops this new idea that hitting people is only prohibited derech nitzayon. Right, so we tried to discuss where does Rambam come with this idea of derech nitzayon, which means in the manner of fighting or something, and why did he come up with it? So my answer was high fives. Right, it has to be, Rambam has to find a way in which high fives are legal. Right, if you have a prohibition against hitting people, well, why are high fives legal? Right, so in the same token, I think that this is an attempt by the Rambam to try and find some way in which he understands that normal people tease each other. Right? And we're not trying to create a society in which affectionate teasing simply can't play a role. So he's trying to define some kind of standard that allows normal human speech interaction.
Yeah, but then he deviates from this.
So now, when you talk about window shopping, right, so you have no relationship with that person. Right, there's nothing gained. That is how you deal with strangers, I think. Right, it comes to strangers, right? There's nothing gained, so he has no interest. There's nothing lost by framing extremes that way. You know, like commercial relationships, but I think he's very careful to leave space. Right, so I think to cause pain is an interesting... You're right, he leaves out the Himba Koach Le'azer Behem, not to shame them. I think it's also an issue about, you know, Habriot, right, is dealing much more with masses, right, you know, people you don't have deep relationships with, as opposed to leaving space for individuals. That would be my best bet. I agree with you that it's not... Yes, sir, Sunday.
Already in Sefer Mitzvot, the Rambam is trying to come up with a conceptual framework for not devouring as direct harm, which puts it more in the commercial realm than in that information, oblique, you know, indirect information sharing realm of what colloquially has come to be called Lashon Hara, whereas the Orchid Time, not the Orchid Tzadikim, undercuts that and is reading it very literally.
Okay, it's interesting that you treat direct damage in acquisition. I would put it in Nezikin, right? Why isn't it Nizkei Dvarim? A window shopping fits in beautifully.
But also, I found interesting the word that the Pinot uses here. Hashem Baruch Hu, who dare talk to yourself, to call them Yudos. Window shopping is a form of communication. In other words, you are communicating to the owner that you're interested in buying, whereas in fact, God knows you're not. So it's commerce, it's onoah devoring, in a certain sense it's an onoah, as a form of subtle communication, of keeping. I think it's very elegant in this. In terms of that word, it's categorized in so Rambam here, instead of creating an own category, is buying that association in Hazarhaus, and reinforcing that as an issue. All these issues are direct pain in one's interaction with others, causing another person in a subtle but direct.
So I understand that Rambam's falling over Matthew, though it's so peculiar that I think that's still a choice, and I agree that the window shopping case fits beautifully there. The reminding about Shuvah of their past doesn't seem, which is the parade example there, doesn't fit anywhere near as well.
Conceptualizing as causing another person pain.
Okay, I'm okay with that. Yeah, that's what I'm just wondering. You know, there is another space for that, and that he doesn't take it
is. And it's always the second. Embarrassment is always the second category. The first category
is pain. Tsar is also a category in Nezik.
What is it?
Yeah, that's why I would. So why not create a new category? Maybe he's just down to the Mishnah's category. Doesn't say, you know, Chevala Bidvarim seems like a nice category to create, though. Yes, sir.
Are you assuming Kalban Aspanim is a separate category, or just like super
Anat Tsar? I don't know. The Rambam has a category of Busha, right? Right. So I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. Right, maybe Ravichander, I think, is right that pain is not the same thing as shame. And here the Rambam focuses on pain in a sense. Yes, Roger?
In some groups, some of the things you're forbidding are actually what allows you to be part of the group. So, for example, football players, after a touchdown or something like that, will really hit each other pretty darn hard.
Yeah.
And that's like saying, hey, you're part of the team.
Sure.
I've heard that teasing, when you call someone, hey, you're a dumb blah, 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 whatever you say, you know, the fact that the guy can take it and you're using that kind of harsh language is a way to get him to be more accepted in the social circle. Now, there are many people who get insulted by that and they drift away, so you're also excluding some people, but in some ways, whether it's, you know, it's like maybe it's a very trait thing that we're doing by doing these sorts of things, but that is how it's...
Is that the kind of society we want, then?
Well,
that would be lovely. Good
social interaction. I mean, it's certainly the case, you know, that the yeshiva societies can often be very chariz. Right? You know, people have people say very sharp things to each other. My own character development. I call you a bit of Dieter, that I often say about myself was, you know, I was chariz. And so my Purim pieces at one point were very famous, I liked my old Purim pieces, and I thought they were important, but at some point I just stopped being able to justify writing them, because they were too harsh. On the other hand, the old ones were too good, so my compromise is I can still quote my old ones, right? but I don't write any of my new ones, and I think that, you know, as the years go on, I'm much less likely to say who they were about. But it's no question that, you know, that's, and one of the things for me in terms of Bali Tshuva is, like, a fascinating thing is that when you meet people you haven't seen in a long time, you start conforming to their expectations, and so I find sometimes when I meet people who haven't seen me in 25 years, that there's immediate expectation that a conversation is going to be full of zingers. And it's very hard not to resist the temptation to just, you know, to become that person again, you know, who is capable. And on the other hand, that, you know, that was, you know, many of my best friends, you know, come out of that experience. So, you know, that's just, it requires a lot of balance. I think that's why, you know, the code word, sort of, say, we say v'yareto me'elokecha, means that this is unenforceable law, it's a devar ha'masur l'lev, it comes, right? The flip side, as I tend to point out, is that the chinuch says that God knows your intentions, is that you can get away with a lot, but also, you know, you're held more accountable. You have to recognize that there's, you know, that it's easy. There are societies in which it really works well to tease people, and everyone gets a lot out of it. There are even societies, I would say, that, you know, I benefit a lot from this, where people tease each other hard about issues that's really important for self-improvement. The dialogue I often quote about myself has a great deal of influence on me. It's why, in some ways, I'm standing before you today. I had a very close friend, who had been sick with mono. So the first thing I did was challenge him to a game of racquetball that he got out of bed, and beat him, because he had always been, you know, because he was sure he was so much better than me. So as I learned, morals are, someone beats you in sports, wait till they get mono and challenge them the day they get out of bed. And it took him years to live that one down, but I did actually win. But the other thing was, you know, so like the second or third day after he came back, I met him in the library after spent 5 minutes in the Beit Midrash, and that was during a time when I was much more into academic Talmud than the Beit Midrash. And so I teased him, I said, you know, was the competition in the Beit Midrash so heavy that you had to go to the library? And he looked at me and he said, yeah, some people make that a life decision. And that was a good line. That was a really good scene. It still resonates with me, and in many ways, that was the line that made me rethink. Whether, in fact, the reason I was hanging out in the library was because, in fact, the competition was much less severe. So I think there's real value in a culture of hard teasing, but also sometimes people get really, sometimes that kind of teasing is really destructive. It becomes a way of asserting dominance, right? It becomes a way of defining the in-group as opposed to the out-group. So I don't know that I would set up an absolute rule, you can't tease people. There are all sorts of things that you might be able to say through teasing that are really important to people that you can't say directly. But you also can't realize, you know, you can't treat this as, well, that's just the way people behave and you have no responsibility. right? Because teasing can also be tremendously painful. I might have reacted, but I just, really badly to that line. Happens, I think I reacted well. Yes, ma'am.
It's interesting in our culture now where there's so much moving between cultures, and that this idea that God knows what's in our heart is very interesting to consider versus being in different cultures where the norm is different. Because you're describing something that, you know, even just a culture that gets created within two friends, that could be something that works for those two friends that we work with.
Sure.
But it's even more severe when we move countries and we move cultures.
Sure, it creates a lot of responsibility to know context. And, because if you have rules, rules are easier, in a sense, even though rules, may lead you to do things that are really positive in some cultures and insulting in other cultures.
Yeah.
Right, if you just write, and you can't really set up rules because the meaning of communication is different, right, is different in different cultures. I learned this, really, in that sense, in that, I think yeshivot tend to be hard-teasing cultures, hard-teasing all-male cultures. And when I first did interdenominational work as a Wexner fellow, so continually miscommunications were things which I just thought were teasing, turned like terribly insulted people, right? You know, I was used to let's say when I was in Yad Yadin, so when my chavrut and I saw an argument developing, right? So we wanted to be psyched up, so we would insult each other for a few minutes, right? Stand up, shout at each other, for a few minutes. Then we were really psyched up. Then we could have some machloket about the Tosfot, right? But it was necessary, to have a kinat, tofri milchamta shel Torah. Those were all things, and we knew perfectly well. The Gemara said, you're enemies while you're fighting, and then you love each other afterwards. And no one thought that we would take those insults too seriously. It was just a way of warming up. But, you try that in an interdenominational Beit Midrash where no one has ever seen anything like that. It's a culture of cooperation, and you're only supposed to say things that are supportive to each other. That really, really didn't work. It took me a long time.
That's why I don't do interdenominational.
It took me a long time to get. Because I was just like saying, we're learning Torah now. That's my culture. that's part of what you do, right? Vilchata shel Torah. It was so wholly alien. It took me, and I'm not instinctively good at that, so it took me a long time to get that, wow, they really mean it, but they're insulted. All right. Okay, so right, Chinuch has many other valuable discussions in here, which I don't want to go through in such depth. He has a whole long discussion, a beautiful discussion of how you respond to other people who are insulting you, in which he says, people aren't supposed to be stones, and you're not supposed to be indifferent. You're supposed to notice when people insult you, when they praise you, and react positively when people praise you. And it's inhuman to be a stone when people insult you. We can talk about that at greater length some other point in the Rambam. And he says that there's some pious people who never want to respond, and God loves them, but they're not really human. It's an interesting dynamic. We can talk about it in much greater length in the Rambam at some point. And he says, the goal, he says, is, right, so he says, fascinating, he says, you can respond to idiots because, you know what, the Torah lets you kill people who are trespassing your house furtively. It lets you insult people who insult you.
That doesn't say insult in any way possible. They make a slap on
it. You can save yourself, right? You can save yourself, right? He says, in any way, right? He treats them as a rodif, right? The fascinating, right, as a pursuer. It's a fascinating category. It's a wild thing. It's a wild, wild thing. But he says the real thing to do, is you should always be nice to people.
Can I be Machal Shabbos to stop him from his own?
No, I don't think so. right? So the real thing is to be nice to people, because only complete idiots insult people who are nice to people. And complete idiots you should just ignore. Right? New category. The people you just don't even bother paying attention to. But real people, right? Real people you don't ignore. You can do all sorts of wild things to them. He also then tells you that you only violate the laws technically if you do the things that are specifically categorized in the Mishnah. Like if you remind about tshuva and things like that. So so Sefer Chinuch has this really broad, generalized ethical principle. And then he says, halachically, there are certain rules I really want to set out. And one of the rules is you can't tease about tshuva about their past. That's an ironclad rule. Yeah.
Once you allow a person to defend himself verbally, it's just going to escalate.
That's a really interesting question. What is the technique?
I say something to you, I don't even think it's an insult, and and you insult me back. And now I'm insulted, and now I'm going to say something which I know is an insult.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, it's an interesting thing in this, you know. On the other hand, you know, he says, you know, people, when you get insulted, it's not reasonable not to react. And he doesn't say just react with sweetness and light. So, you know, it's a complicated notion. I don't have concrete advice. You know, I think there's a book in there, How to Respond to Insults. You know, halakhically, right, ethically. I'm not very good at it. I wouldn't want to write the book. Yes, David.
Well, I think it's reflected in a book that I had routinely with my elementary school teachers, where I maintain that only the person who started the fight should be held responsible. I felt if a bully came over and hit me, I have every right to hit back. Whereas the teacher felt anytime there's a fight, both parties get equally in trouble.
I know the Machlokes. We could frame it. Like, we could do it halachically. By Bava Machteres, the issue is: right, is it? You know, are you allowed to respond, but only at the exact same level? Do we have a doctrine of proportionality? And issues like that, which, you know, comes up in international law now also.
Right. I basically felt the teacher's position was out of laziness for not wanting to really investigate who started.
As a teacher?
Usually you don't.
Not really. as a parent, not really either. Okay. Now, the notion that this only applies to Jews in the Sefer Chinuch comes, as you can see in source number 9, comes from the Gemara's discussion of this, which Rabbi Sender pointed out is at the end of a chapter about currency. Rather peculiar. The issue of currency is that we're trying to figure out what is currency and what is goods, and that relates to the notion of how things have a price, and that gets to overcharging, and that gets us to this. So in that context, the Gemara quotes after lots of famous lines about how it's better to have yourself thrown into a fiery furnace than to humiliate other people in public. And here the Gemara does equate the categories. And again, so now it's Amar of the Chinuch of Breder Avidis, or Chinuch of the son of Avidis said, what does it mean when it says the verse, V'lo tonu ish et amito? So it seems to be probably the best punctuation about this is Am she'itcha b'tora v'mitzot al tonehu. Although so amit becomes Am she'itcha. Now the problem is that Am is a plural, and amitcha sounds like Ishad Amito sounds very much like a singular, but that's what it sounds like. So Am Shitcha B'Torah Mitzvot Al Tonehu, and then we have a line of Rav who says that you should also be careful not to oppress your wife with speech, and then we have the famous story of the Oven of Achnai, in which seems in context, as many people have pointed out over the last 10 years, to be a story not about traditional process, but really a story about whether the rabbi's reaction to Rabbi Eliezer was justified. And the end of that story, part of the end of that story is that Rabbi Eliezer, a third of the world is destroyed because of Rabbi Eliezer's anger, and finally Rabbi Gamliel dies because the gates of Ona'ah are never shut. Right, so really, in context, that story is about the power of Ona'ah. Okay, so what does it mean, Am Shitcha B'Torah V'Mitzvot? So if you take a look at the Shulchan Aruch, right, the Shulchan Aruch says, right, the Rav Yosef Kara himself quotes the Rambam, Kishem Shona'ah V'Mekach U'Memkar, Now, that is left open as to whether that applies only to Jews or not, because the Rambam does say that ona'ah b'mecher, commercial ona'ah only applies to non-Jews, but later in the chapter, only applies to Jews, but later in this chapter, that's in the previous chapter, later in this chapter, he moves into the category of gneva dat, of deception, which he says explicitly applies to non-Jews as well. So this is an intermediate category, we don't know where it fits for the Rambam. Yes?
Don't we usually say with
Amito, we're getting there. Patience. The Ramah comes up and says, the Yeshomrim, the Ein Mitzuvin Elonot Varim El Yirei Hashem. New category, God-fearers. The whole prohibition is only talking to God-fearers. Furthermore, Misha Maneda Atzmo, somebody who oppresses themselves, whatever that means with speech, you're allowed to do it to them. I'm not at all sure what that means. Again, I told you, no tangents, but all sure and connect, you can figure out for yourself how to connect it. Okay, so now the Shita Nikubetsa quotes Rav Yonatan HaKohen Munil, who has an interesting thing. Am Sheitchal Tzorah Mitzvot. He says the reason it says Tzorah Mitzvot is you might even raise the standard further. You might think that not only Yirei Hashem, it has to be Yirei Hashem who were Talmidei Chachamim, that would be with you with Torah and Mitzvot. So they should have, the Rav Yonatan HaKohen Munil rushes to point out either Torah or Mitzvot. Okay, now whether that means that this applies either to people who are good people but can't learn, or people who can learn but are rotten people, right? Because either Torah or Mitzvot, not so clear. Pardon? People who can. Well, that's certainly. But he said. But he tells you that he's going out his way to tell you don't need both, right? It's one or the other. I'm not sure. And then you have the Ritva, who has this wild, wild explanation, who says that Am Sheitcha means your wife. How he got Am Sheitcha to be your wife is utterly beyond me. Yeah, so if it's a itcha, that'd be fine. But Am Sheitcha, I know, not Shim Amma Snapsum, but it's like an amazing.
You had the
Aleph
in the
Shin
reverse in the
Girsa. Pardon?
You had the Aleph in the Shin reverse in the
Girsa. Aleph in the Shin reverse in the Girsa, right. Shay itcha is ishtecha. Very nice. Very nice.
Oh, im ishtecha.
That's why I said it seems to be Am. I mean, so im itcha, im itcha. Yeah, doesn't itcha by itself do that? Im kativ rak itcha, b'li im. The gamkin meshemesh in the larkach. Madu tzrichim ayin mem.
The im sheitcha,
im mi, im sheitcha. Ah, im mi lo tonet im.
No, I'm not sure that this is the explanation of me. The law im yit sheikha. The amit with who, that's why they im sheikha b'torah mitzvot. Who calls amit? Mi
sheikha b'torah mitzvot. Still doesn't convince me. Can't say that, it doesn't convince me. That's clever, that's really clever. I have other darker scholarly possibilities. As in, like, the next one thing is about Ishtecha, and maybe somebody just moved the Ritz's comment up one. but Ruchim Fischer Perlo goes to town on this one, so you can see, and you can also look up, but the notion, right, he suggests that that's why certain people have broader definitions. I'm not at all sure how to line this up. As a contemporary response to Rav Lesner in Bnei Brak, Shevet Alevi, he says, right, he quotes a machloket between the Sma and the Rush, in which the Sma says that really it's two different things, right? And Mishim Anet Atzmo means that the reason, right, there's Yirei Hashem, and secondly, people who are oppressed themselves, they're not called Amitcha, because it's not the way of human beings. Not at all clear what that is. Lavush says it's one thing. Anybody who doesn't fear God is oppressing themselves. You can do whatever you want to them. Strange interpretation. The Aruch HaShulchan says that of course you can oppress a rasha because maybe you'll do tshuva that way. So it all is your kavana. Yirei Hashem, there's no excuse for saying nasty things to. But rishayim, maybe they'll do tshuva if you're mean to them. So it's all up to you.
Yeah, that's.
Or maybe not.
You said that earlier. Yeah. That ties into you were teased about a certain thing, and that you made
right. I don't think a Russia would have reacted quite because I give myself enough credit. If I were a Russia, I don't think that would have worked.
The definition of Russia is someone who's not doing this particular mitzvah that you're commanding.
Aha.
It doesn't mean someone who's like overall Russian.
Could be.
This is how society forces people to do things, yeah. By, you know, ridiculing or demeaning people who don't.
Yeah. All right. I don't know. What I'm interested in mostly.
Right.
It is mostly here in the last line of the Chelek Gimel of the Vosna, where it says, "Lo yadati menale." Right, the Aruch HaShulchan says this. He says, "Lo yadati menale haytama." I don't know where the Aruch HaShulchan made this up. Why? Where he got this from? Because the Chorin here is Zinei Kami Rishonim. Because when I looked at the Rishonim, I thought they were actually creating a rule and not some kind of vague thing. It all depends on Kavana. The iman, right. And what's the rule? They said, "Ima me'aneha rasha." If you oppress a wicked person with words, afal pish in she'ein ra'uy la'asot kein, mikol makom ein ovrim al zed ein amitecha. Right? Nonetheless, you don't violate this, so he's not amitecha, u'kimo begoy, as with non-Jews. And that's a fascinating line, right, where it says that the technical prohibition applies not only just to Jews, but applies to Jews who are your Eshemayim. But doing it to Jews who are not your Eshemayim, like doing it to Gentiles, is nonetheless wrong. Now that's a really interesting category. I know some of my students get upset when we introduce categories like this. But you know, that to me, that brings out the whole tension of Sefer HaChinuch, right? Sefer HaChinuch says, you're not supposed to say mean things to Jews, because what's the principle of this? Peace is good. Right? Peace is necessary for civilization. Peace, right? So why on earth are you creating this distinction in the first place? This is a deep puzzle to me. You know, if you want, and this is a broad issue, if you want to claim that the purposes of certain rules are to set up Jewish society specifically, that's great. And Rav Lichtenstein has this distinction between things that are necessary among brothers and things that are necessary among people, and the things that are related to Jews are things that are necessary among brothers, as opposed to the way in which all human beings. But the Sefer HaChinuch goes out of his way to tell you that these are things which are objective goods. Right? The Rambam puts it in laws of character development. Right? The Rambam leaves it out of character development, but he puts Lashon Hara in there. I have to say that I am really puzzled by the need to set up the formal distinction when you acknowledge uphand that this is the wrong thing to do. Right? Why go out of your way? Now, you have to deal with the textual evidence of mitucha. Okay, so I wanted to do two things in that regard, and then we can finish with that. One is the Nesivos quotes the Sma more completely than Rav Lesner did, and the Nesivos is on the CD, and the Sma isn't, so that's why I'm quoting from here. But he says, the reason that you can oppress somebody who's man edit Sma is, since it's not the way of people to oppress themselves, Eino michlal ha-yishuv derech eretz. Eino nikra mitcha. Right, so this is a really interesting category. People, right, not, as opposed to Yirei Hashem, which is a very high standard. Anyone who doesn't meet that high standard is out of this. The Sma sets up a really low standard. He says, right, people who oppress themselves, right, they're barbarians. They don't have these responsibilities to barbarians. Right, that's an interesting category. I don't know how you set that up. And what does it mean, people who oppress themselves? Right? Does it mean people who are constantly self-deprecating? Right, it's hard to imagine. People who are constantly self-deprecating often come across as tzaddikim. Right? Just because somebody is humble does not mean that you can... You know, it doesn't make sense to me because somebody is humble that you can constantly insult them. Right? So it's a hard category to figure out. But here, what I want to do is...
We were talking about like the extremes, like the lesser issues.
Who sent himself off on wild goose chases? Interesting.
He clearly likes them. He's nice by thinking about a wild goose chase.
I suppose, but I don't know. I don't know. People who put merchandise in the windows that they can never sell, you're allowed to. You're allowed to look at it. I don't know. All right, the Meiri. So here I want to say, but you know. Now the question of the extent to which we paskin like the Meiri on Gentile-Jewish relations, and what the Meiri actually means is a matter of some controversy, which many of you are familiar with. I'll say it's important to say publicly that the legend of the Meiri being external, being somehow uniquely, I tell my students this today, somehow uniquely different from other Rishonim are clearly part of the Masorah the Meiri is not, is just that legend. It's historically false. The Meiri is part of the Masorah all the way through. He's quoted by the Shetim Mekubetzit. He's quoted by the Beis Yosef. He's quoted, right? The Meiri is just part of the Masorah. He's published all the way through, and say a much better story is the Ritva, which doesn't exist in Jewish tradition until the 20th century. So that should be clear, that notion that the Meiri is somehow less part of Jewish tradition than other Rishonim is simply false. And specifically, the Meiri's positions with regard to Gentiles are in the Shetim Mekubetzit and are known all the way through. That's it. Okay, you know, Meiri is a Rishon that was broadly accepted, and certainly if you looked in Western Europe in the late 19th century, nobody would have thought of the possibility of fasting like anybody but the Meiri in terms of Jewish-Gentile relations and his general move to equate, right, to extend all interpersonal obligations to Gentiles because of the Holocaust, right? So people developed a much less trusting attitude towards Western Europeans, and so there was much less of a propensity to follow the Western European tradition of ruling in ways that make that right that assume the equivalence of Jews and Gentiles in all interpersonal matters. Here happens to be the case where what I want to show is that this trend, right, the Sefer HaChinuch's own rationale, the recognition in Rav Lesner, the notion of the wrong, that there are things that is really wrong, whether you put it in this, and particularly the Isma, the Sefer Mirat Inayim's creationist category, Eino B'chal HaYishuv, actually tie in very well to the broad thesis of Miri. Miri says, Kol shegadur b'drachim hadatiyim harehu b'chal onah. Anybody who is bound by the ways of religion, which is a trope in Miri for all civilized people. That's the equivalent of b'chal yishuv haaretz. Harehu b'chal onah. V'lodei ha'elilim, which for him means idol worshippers who have no moral standards whatsoever. Einam b'chal achva, they're not in terms of human relationships. Kidei l'chal olam b'dino na'ah ba'al mi'derech mekach u'memkar, and therefore you can't bring them into the category of ona'ah. And this line is sort of confusing, which comes via commerce, which may mean that he thinks that even of daily lim are in the category of ona'ah that comes via speech. Are you saying that even of daily lim are not in the category of ona'ah, commercial ona'ah? And the only other category is speech ona'ah. So that he excludes them from that may mean that speech ethics are absolutely universal. This is a wild one, Amiri. Lo tonu ishitamito, am shitcha b'tora al-mitzot al-shunei. When for the Amiri, am shitcha b'tora al-mitzot means any civilized people. Am shitcha b'tora al-mitzot means any nation, including non-Jews, who share the fundamentals of Torah and mitzot. So, whereas in some, the Amiri in some places seems more far-fetched than others in halachic reading. Here, it's interesting because the Mirat Inayim really uses language that is directly parallel to the Mirat. The Mirat does this and really is room to spend lots of time trying to figure out, for example, why did Mirat put this principle after the story of Tanur Shalachnai, when the line he's quoting shows up before the story of Tanur Shalachnai in the Talmud. But I want to set out, and this is a broad principle, that when you have a rule which is explicitly defended in ethical categories, there should be a very strong bias, strong bias towards trying not to make distinctions between Jews and non-Jews in that regard. So the Sefer HaChinuch is really incoherent in its attempt. The rationale doesn't match the limitation. Rav Lesner tries, but he ends up having to invent a new category of things that are wrong, and wrong in the exact same way as things that are usher, but he can't, right? Just are not usher. And that's hard. You can try and, innovate it in the Sefer, where the Sefer HaChinuch makes this distinction between things that are technically forbidden, right? And those are things like reminding about Tshuva and reminding a Ger, right? So maybe, right, and those are the only things that he says you violate a law, so maybe what the Sefer HaChinuch really means is that Chazal only chose to codify specific prohibitions in this regard in terms of Gentiles, but of course the broad prohibition, right? The broad ethical principle undermined is universal, right? That seems to me one way of reconciling the Sefer HaChinuch, and to me this is one of the places where the Meiri just makes a lot of sense. The Meiri just makes a tremendous amount of sense, and even has a tradition, because it seems to me if we're setting out a speech ethic, that it's very hard to set out a broad ethical principle without making it universally applicable. So I want to end with that notion, that it seems to me that we are much better off in this case, Paskin like the Meiri. The Meiri has a tradition. Maybe the Meiri is even, maybe the Sefer HaChinuch actually agrees entirely with the Meiri, and that we should we should be thinking really hard about how to frame a Jewish speech ethic that thinks really seriously about how to speak to people. I want to point back that there was something that we missed earlier, which is in the Chinuch itself, where he talks about something we talked about in the Chinuch is in the Yerucha Tzadikim. In the Yerucha Tzadikim, right, at the very end of the Yerucha Tzadikim, the last paragraph, where he talks about in general that speech ethics doesn't only mean avoiding these kinds of lashon hara, it means comforting the poor. That's one of its categories: comforting the poor, rebuking the wicked, and comforting the poor. So there's a whole range of ways in which speech can be both positive or negative. And what I want to, like the two takeaways I'd like to come away from this with is, one is that notion that we need to reorient Jewish speech ethics about speech to as opposed to speech about. We'll talk the next 2 weeks about how we should reorient the whole category of speech about independently. And secondly, that in these kinds of areas, we're really much better off if we frame it, especially in an integrated society, but not only an integrated society, if we frame it as how we deal with human beings as opposed to how we deal with fellow Jews, which often ends up leading, because anything which tells you that it's okay to talk to other people this way, not to this people, ends up destroying character as opposed to building it, leaving aside the Filo Hashem aspect. All right, thank you. Question number, yes.
Who's called Gadol Midrashim kind of team?
I have a lecture online about popsing like an area.
Even though it's simply popsing like that. Who's
no, I have a lecture online about what it means. Much better, right? You can read that one, and we can dive. I don't want to give a 45-minute lecture in answer to a question. All right. Thank you all very, very much for coming. Please come back next week, and we'll talk about speech about.